Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Former Florida Senator Bob Graham recently said this about the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. He said that for the past 20 years, Washington has played an assertive role in covering up Saudi Arabia's complicity in acts of terrorism. Graham is the former co-chair of the Joint Congressional Investigation into the 9/11 attacks. 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. And now he's closely watching the fallout from the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. This hour on Point, Senator Bob Graham on why Washington should stop coddling the Saudi kingdom. And you can join us. Do you think the Saudi government can or should be held accountable for the killing of Jamal Khashoggi? What questions do you have for Senator Graham about the role of Saudi Arabia's the role Saudi Arabia possibly played in the 9/11 attacks? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And a little later this hour, we're going to be talking about the polio-like illness that's affecting children in at least 20 states across the country. That's later this hour. But first, we're going to spend some time with Senator Bob Graham. He joins us today from Miami, Florida. He was a Democratic U.S. Senator from 1987 to 2005 and chairman of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence from 2001 to 2003. He was co-chair of the Joint Congressional Investigation into the 9/11 attacks. Senator Graham, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna.
It's very good to have you, and I want to talk with you in detail about your long history of investigation and observation of the Saudi kingdom. But let me first start off with your reaction and response, hearing that today the Saudi prosecutor is saying that the killing of Jamal Khashoggi was a premeditated act. They're finally saying that. I mean, what's your response to that being said now?
Well, that appears to be a movement towards the truth, which has been long in coming and multiple in specific events. I hope that the United States will take this matter with great seriousness and will facilitate an expedited understanding of what did happen and a movement towards bringing justice to the journalist and his family and send a signal that the United States is not going to tolerate further actions by Saudi Arabia which endanger, kill U.S. persons.
Yeah. I'm wondering, Senator Graham, if you see a familiar pattern in how both Riyadh and Washington have handled the slow metamorphosis of revelations around the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. I mean, from Riyadh's part, I mean, we went from absolute denial to several, you know, on the face of it, ludicrous assertions that he was killed in a fist fight, to all the way now to finally this acknowledgement that it was a premeditated act. I mean, does that sort of evolution or does that pattern look familiar to you in any way?
Yes. For instance, at 9/11, in the hours after 9/11, President Bush stated that the United States would go to the ends of the world to find who had committed this heinous act and bring them to justice. He also said that it appeared as if from the scale of the operation and its sophistication that it a nation state was involved, and that that nation state was Iraq. And we then proceeded to go to war with Iraq with very dire circumstances. I think that was the beginning scene of the cover-up of Saudi Arabia's involvement in 9/11, that it, not Iraq, provided 15 of the 19 hijackers. It was it which had placed people in the United States months or in some cases years ahead of 9/11 who played a critical role in organizing and facilitating 9/11.
Yeah. Senator Graham,
seem to have had some of the same shifting of responsibility in this latest case.
Yeah, and forgive me for interrupting you there, but this is exactly why I wanted to invite you on the program today, because I saw you on PBS a couple of days ago saying that you believe that Washington, under multiple administrations, has played a, quote, assertive role in helping cover up Saudi Arabia's complicity in acts of terrorism. And, you know, I mean, someone with your experience and the fact that you were the co-chair of the 9/11 Commission means that your words carry some weight. But, you know, here we are almost 20 years later from 9/11, and the commission itself did not provide that particular conclusion that that you've been saying, you know, individually since then. So how do we square that?
The facts are the facts. What I've been urging is that the United States government, particularly the FBI and the CIA, make public the information which they have, and then let the people evaluate what's known and come to a judgment as to responsibility.
And this is information you have seen?
Yes. You may remember it was almost exactly a year ago that the so-called 28 pages, which were 28 pages of the 9/11 report itself,
indeed,
which had been withheld for more than a year, and it was finally leaked out, although with significant redactions that covered up much of the most salient information. So I think my mantra is, let the people know the truth and let the people make their judgment as to responsibility for 9/11.
Well, to be fair, though, Senator Graham, I mean, when those 28 pages came out in 2016, many folks in Washington and even the administration and the FBI itself asserted that there was not necessarily anything new in those 28 pages, that other investigations had gone on with regarding the information in those 28 pages, and that there was no conclusions made. But there are very interesting parts of those 28 pages. I mean, for example, one of the most revealing things is that the documents describe a gentleman named Osama Baznan, who was a supporter of two of the 9/11 hijackers in California, that this gentleman actually received a check from Saudi Prince Bandar, a $15,000 check, and his wife did, at least at one time, as well. But can we take how can we go from that, though, to proving conclusively the complicity of the Saudi royal family?
Well, it's a matter of looking at all the evidence that's available and drawing a conclusion.
Yeah.
Someone was responsible for 9/11. Originally, there was the idea that the only people who were involved were Osama bin Laden and his immediate acolytes. But the sophistication of 9/11, the time that it took to plan, organize, and execute was of such a length that it appeared as if, as President Bush said initially, that a nation state was involved in 9/11. And I believe that the evidence points strongly towards Saudi Arabia being that nation state.
Well, there are many of your former colleagues, or some at least of your former colleagues in Washington, who feel very similarly. Because back in 2016, when those 28 pages that had been previously redacted were released to the public, I actually spoke with Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch, who was one of the folks instrumental in getting those pages released or declassified to the public. And when he talked to me, he expressed his dismay at what he said was the FBI's unwillingness, or the fact that the FBI didn't investigate some of these Saudi connections.
What is really damning about this is that in spite of the fact that there were 19 hijackers and all these connections between the Saudi government and the hijackers. The FBI never engaged in an investigation of the Saudi connection. It was only when the Congress came together and appointed the special inquiry. That was a year later. And what did they say? What did the FBI say when the 9/11 Commission contacted them for evidence? They said, "We knew you would do that. We knew you would do that." So they basically let the trail end right there. A major attack killing thousands of Americans, and the FBI puts their feet up?
That's Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch speaking to me back in 2016. Senator Graham, there's a story from a couple of years ago, which I'm not sure that many people know about. It's been reported in Florida, but I think it's an example of what you're saying about how you see Washington being assertive in assisting its covering up Saudi Arabia's alleged complicity in some of these serious acts over time. And I read about it in Sarasota Magazine, and it's about the fact that in 2011, you were made aware of a young Saudi couple that might have been providing some material assistance to several of the hijackers who were training, doing flight training in nearby Venice, Florida. Is that right?
Yes. The basic facts of that situation were that three of the hijackers who were doing flight training at a flight school near Sarasota were found to have had a long relationship while they were in Sarasota with a prominent Saudi family which had lived in Sarasota for approximately 6 years. A few days before 9/11, that family left their home, a quite spacious home in Sarasota, under what were subsequently described as urgent conditions.
Senator Graham, stand by here for a second because we have to take a break, and I want to hear the rest of this story when we come back. We're talking with former Florida Senator Bob Graham. He was the former co-chair of the Joint Congressional Investigation into the 9/11 attacks. He's been watching Saudi Arabia for two decades now, and it says it's time for Washington to stop coddling the kingdom. We'll hear more from him when we come back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking with former Florida Senator Bob Graham. He was the co-chair of the Joint Congressional Investigation into the 9/11 attacks. He's been watching Saudi Arabia for almost 20 years now, and he's saying that it's time for Washington to really stop coddling the Saudi kingdom. Senator Graham, I hope you can forgive me that I had to cut you off there before the break, because you were telling us this very interesting story about a Saudi couple, a young Saudi couple in Sarasota, Florida, who you first heard about in 2011. Now, if I'm reading the reporting around this correctly, that they lived in a gated community, right? And in fact, the name of Mohammed Atta, the leader of the 9/11 hijackers, and his license plate information were on file in the office of this gated community, indicating that maybe he'd been coming in and out. And that later on, the FBI Tampa office had actually compiled a lengthy report about with connections between the hijackers and this family. But would the FBI give you that report?
No. And after attempting to get access to the report, we, which was some journalists and myself, filed a Freedom of Information Act to get access. Initially, the FBI said they didn't have any information on the three flight students and the Saudi family. The judge rejected that as being unbelievable. They then said that they had a few documents and that was all there was. The judge rejected that. Then, without further action, the FBI voluntarily directed 80,000 pages of information that had been taken in a post 9/11 survey of the situation in Sarasota, with the judge then to determine which of those 80,000 pages could be made public. It is now almost November of 2018, and after 6 years, the judge has yet to rule on what, if any, of those 80,000 pages can be made available to the American public.
Okay. Senator Graham, I want to take a step back here, though, because you're right. So those 80,000 pages are currently in the possession of a Florida federal judge. 80,000 pages about this one family, or at least investigations in Sarasota, not yet made available to the public in any way, shape, or form. But even before the judge made that decision to start taking a look at those pages, I mean, you had contacted the FBI, right, to ask for some of the reports at least. And did you had to even go to the FBI's central record keeping office to even see some of these reports, and that the FBI wasn't being cooperative in giving you any information? Is that right?
Well, I would say the FBI was being quite uncooperative. In fact, at one point, shortly after the situation in Sarasota was discovered, my wife and I were in the Washington area to have Thanksgiving with our third daughter, and we were intercepted at Logan Airport and taken to the FBI office, which is located there. And essentially told by the number two person, the deputy director of the FBI, that we were wasting our time and that I should shut up and go home.
You were the co-chair of the 9/11 commission, and the number two person at the FBI was telling you were wasting your time trying to follow a lead about what the FBI investigated regarding possible connections between a Saudi family and the hijackers? I mean— It almost yes. defies belief, Senator.
Well, and it gets worse. So I told the deputy director that the information that I wanted, and he said, "Well, come to our office and we will talk about this." So I did, and when I got there, the deputy director told me that the meeting that we were going to have had been canceled and it would not be rescheduled, and that, again, I was wasting my time. That's the last quasi-official contact that I have had with the FBI on the Sarasota situation.
Senator, 9/11, you know, we're 17 years out, and anybody who was alive and remembers that day will never forget it. I mean, thousands of people were killed. And I'm hearing you tell me that the FBI, as late as 2011, was actively trying to dissuade you from, as a United States senator, from trying to find out what federal investigators may have known or uncovered. And you've said before with utter conviction that you believe that the United States already has within its possession information that it ought to make available to the public about Saudi complicity in this massive act of terrorism. Why is that not happening? Who is stopping that from happening?
Well, the mystery is over three administrations, why has there been this reticence to release information? I think for the Bush administration, the reason was that they wanted to put the blame for 9/11 on Iraq, and anything that raised the possibility that another nation state was responsible ran counter to that narrative. The enigma to me is the Obama administration. President Obama had run in 2008 in large part on his opposition to the war in Iraq, and had raised questions about Saudi Arabia and why it wasn't more a focus of attention. But in spite of that, nothing was done in his administration to expedite the release of information on 9/11. And now President Trump has made Saudi Arabia one of the darlings of U.S. foreign policy. It was the first country that he visited as president, has been very fulsome in his statements of approval of Saudi Arabia. And so we've gone for three presidencies and no assertive effort from the White House to let the American people share the information that the government has and form opinions as to responsibility for 9/11.
Yeah, and I'm going to take a couple quick calls here, Senator, but just one more thing to reiterate. There has been no official report so far that I know of that's even willing to entertain this thought, that no official report saying that there's any evidence of Saudi complicity in any of these acts that we've been talking about. But, I mean, would you go so far as to say that you have seen, again, in your time as co-chair, as 9/11 commissioner, that you've seen evidence or documentation or something, anything that ties the Saudi royal family itself to something like 9/11?
Yes. I mean, I think the 28 pages, you've already cited the one situation where Prince Bandar, who was the ambassador of Saudi Arabia to the United States, was involved in financing persons who played a critical role in 9/11.
Well, let's go to a caller here. Charlie is calling from New Orleans, Louisiana. Charlie, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Megan, Senator Graham. My question is, you know, Saudi Arabia is obviously a big major ally in the Middle East, certainly with respect to foreign policy with Iran. There are more conservative factions of Sunni within Saudi Arabia, specifically Wahhabism. How does the U.S. balance the tension where you have the more extremists and some of the alleged terrorist funding coming from the Wahhabi sect with trying to support King Salman and Crown Prince MBS, as well as trying to balance the foreign policy matter in the Middle East? Thank you.
Charlie, thanks for your call.
Yeah. Let me state that I do not represent myself to be an expert on the history of Saudi Arabia or the history of U.S. relations with Saudi Arabia. But I do know that when the country of Saudi Arabia was formed, there were several key players, and one of which was the royal family. Another were the clerics of this extreme version of Islam called Wahhabism. And the United States has taken a position of essentially placating both the monarchy and the clerics, and there has been a major rush in recent years, say since the end of World War II, to expand the reach of Wahhabism in places where it had not been known before, such as the Balkans and Indonesia. And that has moved the Islam into an increasingly more strident form of religion. I think that the United States needs to have a pause and look at all the implications of Saudi Arabia in terms of U.S. interest. I think we've put too much importance on their large reservoir of oil, mm-hmm. which was the original reason for this close relationship. And in fact, with what has happened in the last decade, the United States is probably more oil independent than it has been in any time in the modern era, is less reliant on Saudi Arabia and is in a stronger position to demand actions which represent what a modern state that respects human rights and would not do things like cut up a journalist and a heinous murder or kill 3,000 Americans by hijacked airplanes.
Senator Graham, you've been looking at this. How much of your time do you still spend trying to investigate or understand further Saudi Arabia's role in 9/11?
Well, it varies. For instance, this Sarasota situation would not have been known but for the fact that a journalist writing a book on the 10th anniversary of 9/11 happened to go to Sarasota to talk to the people at the flight school, and in the course of those conversations found out about the relationships between the three students and the Saudi family. That resulted in a sharp increase in the time and attention that I was spending on this matter.
I asked that, Senator, because it still sends a chill down my spine to hear you again as the co-chair of the 9/11 Commission saying with total certainty that you believe that, you know, the United States has within its possession evidence that it's not letting the American people see, and that instead, you know, we went to war in Iraq at the cost of, you know, trillions of dollars and many, many thousands of lives, and that perhaps this pattern of coddling Saudi Arabia continues to this very day. I presume other members of the commission saw the same documentation and evidence that you saw. Why are more people not speaking out about this?
I can't speak for others. I can just speak for what I have personally seen, read, talked to persons directly involved, and the conclusions that I have reached, which are that 9/11 would not have occurred but for the facilitation provided by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
It just seems so, forgive me, Senator, but it just seems so strange that other members of the commission aren't saying those same things. I mean, is there a disconnect? I know you can't explain what other people do, but it just seems like some kind of disconnect there that I can't fathom.
Maybe if the information were made more broadly available, they would come to my opinion. Now, I will say that as one of the two co-chairmen, I had access to more information and more intensely over a period of 2 years, and then have followed incidents such as Sarasota subsequent to our investigation. There's not a word about Sarasota in our final report because we didn't know about Sarasota mm-hmm. until almost a decade later.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm very grateful that you came to join us today, because this isn't about just what happened on September 11th, 2001. It's about, you know, a pattern of a behavior and a relationship between Washington and Riyadh in the subsequent 17 years that also leads us to this moment regarding the ongoing issues about Jamal Khashoggi and, you know, even how the U.S. operates regarding Saudi Arabia's bombing of Yemen. But I just have 1 minute left here in the time that I have with you, Senator. And if you allow me, I just need to switch gears a little bit, because I want to just get your quick take on the domestic news that we've all been thinking about those multiple pipe bombs that have been sent, 10 of them at least, now to various politicians and CNN. I'm just wondering what your take is on the fact that that's happening now. And we just have about 30 seconds.
Well, it is the latest instance in which our politics has become so so violent, this is something that political candidates need to be talking about and giving some direction to the American people as to what can we do to come back to the reasoned democracy which the United States has been known for almost 2.5 centuries.
Well, Senator Bob Graham, he was the United States Senator from Florida from 1987 to 2005. During that time, he served as the chairman of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence from 2001 to 2003, and he was the co-chair of the congressional investigation into the 9/11 attacks. Senator Bob Graham, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Magda.
Well, when we come back, we'll talk about those polio-like symptoms that are showing up in 20 American states. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Weakness in the arms and legs, possible paralysis, sick children. It sounds like polio, but medical professionals are keeping an eye on a growing number of cases of acute flaccid myelitis, a condition that the Centers for Disease Control says is affecting at least 155 patients in 22 states. It's rare, but serious, and the disease affects the nervous system, and its causes aren't entirely known. Well, you can join us, because we'll be speaking in a moment with a doctor who's been treating patients with acute flaccid myelitis, and we want to know what your questions are about this disease. Have you seen it sicken children in your community? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining us now from Dallas, Texas, is Dr. Benjamin Greenberg. He's a professor in the Department of Neurology and Neurotherapeutics at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. He's also an expert in treating rare autoimmune disorders of the central nervous system. And he's already treated 8 patients with acute flaccid myelitis this year. Dr. Greenberg, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Magna. Happy to be here.
So first of all, just give us the non-sensational facts about this disease. This is a virus that it's not unknown to science. We've seen it before.
You're correct. And the facts also are part of the issue relative to some confusion. So when we talk about acute flaccid myelitis, it is a clinical diagnosis. It refers to a certain set of symptoms and a certain type of damage that can occur in the spinal cord, usually in children, but it can affect adults. There are multiple ways to damage this part of the spinal cord, but since 2014, every other year, in the late summer, early fall, the United States has seen a spike in number of children who have become paralyzed with this phenotype of a condition, acute flaccid myelitis. And the suspicion has been that during these seasons, every other year, there has been a circulating virus or viruses that has been responsible for the majority of those cases.
Okay, and that's an enterovirus?
It is. That's the suspicion. The enteroviruses are a group of viruses that are very common, usually cause either respiratory or gastrointestinal illnesses that are usually quite mild. Most people don't even know it when they've been infected with an enterovirus. And if it does cause symptoms, it's a common cold. And then in very rare situations, certain enteroviruses have been associated with damage to the central nervous system.
I see. So help me understand something, though, because recently we've been seeing these quite worrying headlines, right, about polio-like symptoms in some children who are being infected with this. And you say that we started seeing a spike beginning in 2014. So, but the enterovirus wasn't leading to these same symptoms before that?
So it turns out that it probably was. So if we go back to 2012, there were a few cases reported out of California, and the California Department of Public Health recognized that there were some enterovirus-associated acute flaccid myelitis patients. And when we look back even in Dallas, as far back as 2009, it's quite clear that there were some cases. The difference between 2010, 2012, and then what happened in 14, 16, and 18 was the magnitude of number of cases being recognized.
So this,
and the symptoms, the syndrome, looks essentially like poliomyelitis, which was described well over 100 years ago before we knew about the poliovirus as the predominant cause of this syndrome during the early 1900s through the 1940s, before we had a vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
Once we essentially got rid of the poliovirus within the United States, the syndrome of poliomyelitis or acute flaccid myelitis, which look almost identical with a few unique features between them, the poliomyelitis that we were used to essentially disappeared, but we think there have been a background of rare paralytic events, mainly in kids, happening for several decades. But something has changed, whether in the hosts, us as a population, or within the viruses circulating, to start causing these much more significant and prevalent outbreaks since 2012, 2014.
And so that something is what researchers are trying right now to figure out.
We are. There are groups all across the United States and indeed around the world, because we have seen outbreaks in Europe as well on a similar pattern. Where we are trying to determine if there is one or multiple causes for these outbreaks in the late summer, early fall. And what's notable is the virus that has received the most attention, which is within the family of enteroviruses, all of these viruses are cousins of the poliovirus. And so while we have not detected the poliovirus in any of these cases when testing has been done, in a large number of cases, we have found a different enterovirus that seems to cause damage to the spinal cord.
Okay, so this is where medicine and epidemiology get a little bit ahead, I think, of common understanding. Because I heard you say earlier that these enteroviruses are also very common, and maybe some of them are cousins to the poliovirus. But if they're so common, I don't know of there's no current vaccine for the virus which may be causing these current spikes of polio-like syndromes, is there?
Correct. There is no available vaccine for these viruses.
Okay. Are researchers wondering if perhaps we need to go down the path of developing one?
It is a very active conversation that's happening now. And where our focus is first is in trying to prove causation, so that if we and when we invest the significant resources it takes to make a vaccine, we're picking the right virus to develop a vaccine for. And so where our focus has been for several years is trying to get a consensus among researchers and public health officials that we think we have the right culprit. And it turns out that the virus or family of viruses that we're most interested in are actually somewhat difficult to capture from these patients. They're difficult to isolate and difficult to confirm. The testing for them is not easy. And so often we'll have children who have the syndrome acute flaccid myelitis but test negative based on our current technology for the specific enterovirus we're looking for, but it doesn't mean they didn't have it. If we look back to the lessons of the poliovirus, when we would test the spinal fluid of a child who was being actively paralyzed by this virus, and this virus was replicating in their spinal cord and causing damage and affecting the nerves that control the muscles, we can't isolate the virus out of the spinal fluid. It's a very difficult virus to find. And so when we diagnose the poliovirus even today, we do so by checking a stool specimen because the virus replicates within the gastrointestinal tract. So if you have a child with paralysis and you're worried that it could be due to the poliovirus, we don't look to the spinal cord or the spinal fluid because we can't find it. We have to look elsewhere in the body.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to sort out the same processes for the enteroviruses. Now, the reassuring part of this relative to the history of poliovirus is in the world of poliovirus, back in the 1930s and 1940s when we had tens of thousands of children being paralyzed by this virus, was that for every 100 to every 1,000 people who would get infected with this virus, somebody would become paralyzed.
Mm-hmm.
And so its virulence, its ability to invade and damage the spinal cord was quite high. The best estimates for the enterovirus that we're most concerned about is that it's maybe 1 in 100,000 infections.
So very, a very low rate then.
Very low rate, and so we are trying to be very reassuring to all of the families and parents out there. And I'm a father. I have two daughters, and one of them has a cold right now. And I have to remind myself that overwhelmingly the odds are she is not going to suffer a neurologic complication. Where we are focusing our concern is at the public health level of if there is a virus circulating that is the cause of the majority of these cases and that virus is changing over time, could we be facing a problem 10 or 20 years from now that we could avoid by certain investments into certain scientific endeavors now in 2018?
Yeah, it's always that epidemiology arms race when you first start seeing a pattern in infections. Well, we are talking with Dr. Benjamin Greenberg. He's joining us today from Dallas, Texas. He's a professor in the Department of Neurology and Neurotherapeutics at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. And we're talking about this enterovirus, which is causing, in some rare cases, as he said, but polio-like symptoms in children. And we've seen that in at least 22 states this season. Dr. Greenberg, let's just take a quick caller here. Liz is calling from Meridian, Connecticut. Liz, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I'm calling because my daughter in 2016 actually was hospitalized for about 2 months with polio-like symptoms, and they did ultimately diagnose her with acute flaccid myelitis. It was a very confusing process when she first got sick. They did tons and tons of testing and eventually diagnosed her as transverse myelitis. Now, obviously, there's some slight differences between those things, but very similar. She had lost the ability to stand, to walk. She couldn't move her right side of her body. She couldn't breathe on her own. Thankfully, they did plasmapheresis and a lot of physical therapy and occupational therapy and steroids and tons of antibiotics, and eventually she was released right around this time in 2016. So she had gotten sick right at the end of August. And now, 2 years later, she has regained most of her mobility. The only lasting effect is she does have some muscle weakness in her right shoulder, which is kind of where it was the original paralysis was onset. So we've made a lot of improvement in recovery, but I've noticed that there's a lot of misinformation about how to kind of treat these cases and what the best course of action is.
Well, Liz, first of all, I was hoping that you would end your call with some good news about your daughter. So I'm so delighted that she's, it sounds like, almost almost entirely recovered. And thank you for your call so much. But Dr. Greenberg, let me just turn to you here, because Liz was saying, as she just said, that she's hearing a lot of misinformation about appropriate courses of treatment or how to address these cases when they come into doctors' offices or hospitals. What do you say?
So I agree with you, Meg. I appreciate the call. I think, first off, Liz, I'm thrilled to hear that your daughter is getting better. It's what we wish for all of the children and families who've been through this horrific experience. And you highlight actually three of the key areas of controversy that exist that are being discussed within the field of neurology and infectious diseases right now. The first controversy you raised, or the first challenge that you raised, was around diagnosis, mm-hmm. recognition and diagnosis. And the language that gets used within neurology in this area can be quite confusing, both for patients, families, and practitioners. There is a term, transverse myelitis, which simply means inflammation of the spinal cord. So any inflammation of the spinal cord, we lump it into this category of transverse myelitis. Acute flaccid myelitis is a subtype where basically we're saying that inflammation in the spinal cord is predominantly affecting one type of cell within the spinal cord. It's targeting one area. And so a lot of children who come in with acute flaccid myelitis originally are assigned the term transverse myelitis, and then it's clarified which type they have. The reason that diagnosis of acute flaccid myelitis is important and recognizing this subtype is important is because it leads to discussions around treatment regimens. And Liz, you pointed out that your daughter went through a variety of treatments in the hospital and then afterwards. And there is a large discussion going on right now around how should we be treating patients who've been diagnosed with acute flaccid myelitis. And it's worth noting that there is disagreement in the field. There are therapies that we use to dampen down inflammation in the spinal cord, steroids, which are medicines that can reduce inflammation, and then a procedure called plasmapheresis or plasma exchange, which has been shown to be of benefit to children who have transverse myelitis. But in the setting of acute flaccid myelitis, it's controversial. And the concern is, if there is an active virus replicating in the spinal cord, could steroids or plasmapheresis, which dampens down the immune response, could it lead to an escape of that virus and more significant damage?
Right. So, because whenever you use immunological therapies, there's always that risk. You know what, Dr. Greenberg? We have about a minute and a half here left to go, and you know, you said you're a parent. I'm a parent. I'm thinking of all the parents out there listening right now, and I think there's just a really basic question I need to ask you. That if, say, you see your kid with something like cold symptoms, at what point in time should a parent begin to perhaps be concerned? Or if you find yourself in the doctor's office, what questions should you be asking of your doctor, you know, around whether or not the possibility of infection with this enterovirus is something we ought to be thinking about?
Absolutely, Magna. And the three points I'd make is, first, the time for concern is not at the point of a cold, because overwhelmingly, kids are going to get colds and they're going to do fine. If, however, as a parent, you recognize any weakness of one or more limbs or difficulty swallowing, then that should always prompt an evaluation by a healthcare provider. And in the situation, if it ever does arise, where you feel like there is a disconnect between you and your healthcare provider around the assessment of that weakness, seeking a second opinion is always warranted, so that children can be evaluated to determine if they're having a neurologic event. And Magna, I would be remiss if I didn't just add one more thing relative to Liz's question, and that's around the use of those therapies. And I just have to say, once we identify acute flaccid myelitis, at least in our experience at our center, the use of the anti-inflammatory therapies in certain children have led to recoveries much like Liz's child. And so we are encouraging everybody within the public health sphere and within centers to have an active conversation to sort out what would be the best treatments once these cases are identified.
Well, Dr. Benjamin Greenberg, professor in the Department of Neurology and Neurotherapeutics at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center, thank you so much for joining us today and giving us some expert and considered analysis of something which I think has been grabbing a lot of people's attention in the headlines. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.